why your refrigerator may be the next battleground in the cause of freedom. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to the Saturday edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, my Vice Chairman of the Institute, fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
And all I can say is your refrigerator running?
Yeah, exactly. So you better go stop it.
Yeah, just ran past my house. Better come get it.
That's right. No, Chuck, you and I, as we go through and do analysis and we look at what's going on around us in the world, we see things that sometimes you just have to sit there and shake your head and say, what's the world coming to? Well, we're going to tie this all together, ladies and gentlemen, so bear with us because it may sound a little disjointed at first, but we're getting to the point of the bump that we use to come into the program. Chuck, did you know that yesterday, Friday, was considered Thursday, I forget what day we're on, that there was a special event that happened in Washington, D.C.? Now, we know that most special events that happen in Washington, D.C. usually end up costing us our money or our freedom.
Yeah.
But this was one that was done by the National Center for Public Policy Research. And it was very special because it's something that you haven't seen done very often, except maybe for if you want to classify the Occupy Wall Street movement as doing this. But what they had was what they called a lunch-in. Not a luncheon. You know, we all yes. have luncheons. This was a lunch-in. And it was done in response to what had happened last week in the state of North Carolina, where elementary school children who had brought their lunch to school from home had their lunch taken away from them and were forced to eat the cafeteria lunch on the grounds that their lunch that they had packed from home was not nutritious enough. I'm sure I can see in your eyes here.
Yes.
We're sitting in the studio. I can see in your eyes here. You're asking the question, well, what was in that lunch? Was it full of Twinkies and potato chips? My guess is that would have probably been even more nutritious than what they served them at the cafeteria.
Well, listen, from what I remember about cafeteria food in school, if it wasn't radioactive, they fed it to us.
Okay. Well, you're right. I'm going to give you the offending lunch. Here is what was packed by mom at home and given to the child, a preschooler, actually. So this was even before elementary school. It's a preschooler at West Hoke Elementary School in North Carolina. Her mother had packed a turkey and cheese sandwich. I'm not sure about the nutrition value of all that stuff, you know, white bread and processed turkey and American cheese.
Here's the problem. We don't know if it was on white bread or
maybe. See, that's exactly. We do not know that.
Turkey and cheese on wheat, you know.
It could be, very well have been as much. A banana. We know that bananas are just off the list of things that are nutritious for you.
Yeah, we can't have kids ingesting all that potassium.
That's right. Potato chips. I see now where it's just basically you're just competing with the school. And apple juice. To me, that sounds like it's probably a pretty highly nutritious lunch, but I'm sure that the school officials really felt that what they were going to feed to the child was much more nutritious than that. 3 chicken nuggets.
Yes, we can't have children ingesting turkey when they could ingest chicken.
Chicken, that's right.
No, so the evil bird turkey that Benjamin Franklin once wanted as the national symbol of the United States, the turkey, is apparently, as far as school nutrition officials are concerned, is an inedible poultry.
Well, honestly, I got to say that was one area where I think Ben Franklin was wrong because I think yes. turkey is probably much more palatable than bald eagle. although a bald eagle sandwich does sound kind of exotic, doesn't it? No, but seriously now. What we had was a government official, because this was a school official, and let's not kid ourselves, ladies and gentlemen, your public schools are government entities, okay? This was a government official who decided to intervene in the choice that a parent had for the care and support and health of their own child and replaced what is at the very least on the surface sounds like a very nutritious and well thought out lunch. It's balanced. You've got your meat, you've got your milk products, you've got your fruits and vegetables, and you have your grains
right.
all in this. So honestly, they want to talk about the food pyramid and all this balance. This thing sounded extremely balanced. So what do they give this child in return? 3 processed chicken nuggets. Okay, now I'm telling you right now, Chuck, I know I saw an article here a while back of some young lady in England who all she's eaten all of her entire life since she's been about 2 years old has been chicken nuggets and french fries.
Yeah.
But she's now experiencing significant health problems because of it. This is where government agents want to come in and tell you what's good for you. Because they think they know better. Now, honestly, I don't think anybody believes that a handful of chicken nuggets in a pre-processed in a school lunch in the institutional cafeteria setting of a school is going to be more healthy and nutritious than a homemade meal from the parents.
I see two prongs on this pitchfork, and you can probably see more. The first prong is the fact that the government is assuming, once again, that they are the appointed stewards of the health of your child.
That is one point of the fork.
Meaning,
yes.
Really, that what they're claiming is that they have ownership of your child.
Well, see, that they've redefined the phrase in loco parentis, which is what that's Latin for in place of the parent.
In place of the parents.
And that is what happens when you send your child to a public school, is when they cross the threshold, supposedly, the officials and the teachers in that school are working in place of the parent. Now, problem is, it's how you define that. See, with the public schools, they think in place of the parent means parents out of the way and we get to do what we want. The historic viewpoint on that, the actual real definition of the Latin,
that's right,
means to fill in for the parent in the same manner in which the parent would address the issues of the child. Not saying the parent has no place and we'll tell you what you're going to do because we're your new parents. You know, that's more the Cruella de Vil method of doing
it. It's essentially the attitude that modern universities and colleges have assumed.
Yes.
And that is that the old way of looking at it was the colleges stood in loco parentis in place of the parents, and therefore you couldn't do anything basically that your parents wouldn't allow. You couldn't move in with your girlfriend or without fear of being thrown out of the college. You couldn't spend all your evenings drunk and disorderly and remain in the college. Now you're kind of coming full circle back. They don't want you drunk and disorderly either. But the fact is, that's because you tend to destroy the college's property.
Right.
It has nothing to do with standing in the place of parents and attempting to maintain the moral atmosphere that the parents would do. They don't really care about your morality. What they don't want you to do is get drunk and trash the place and bring bad name on, you know, start fires downtown and bring bad name on the college. That's really all they care about because it's all about money. I see a second tine on this pitchfork.
Okay, keep going.
The second tine I see is that schools collect money as a subsidy whenever they can get one of the kids onto their program.
Onto the school lunch program
and off the home-based meal.
I see. Now, that's a prong of the fork that I wouldn't have paid much attention to, but you have a good point there, Chuck. And that's the reason why he's here as a co-host and as a fellow analyst, because he has figured a part of this that I didn't even see out. See, I was looking at
you to come to it.
You're right, though. I saw a third prong, though. And the prong that I was looking at with this was the idea that if you have a child who actually is getting good nutrition, they're going to learn more. And if they learn more, that means they're going to excel. And if they're going to excel, that means that the school's going to have to pay extra resources for gifted students.
Oh, well, I don't want to go quite that paranoid, but there may be something to that way of thinking. Honestly, from what I've seen from so-called quote-unquote dietary experts, most of them don't know their behinds from third base.
And speaking as a biochemist and who is in the nutritional field, you know what you're talking about.
And visit my website. We're a sponsor of this program. RainRockNutritionals.com. That's RainRockNutritionals.com. That being said, there may be something to that argument that, in fact, it's not really so much about what's good for your child. It's basically being in control of your child.
And that is a dangerous portion of this issue. It's that idea that government controls, and here we're talking about a four-year-old girl. It's easy for a government agent to come in on a four-year-old child and say, your mommy may, you can't have that, and we'll take that away from you here. You take what we're going to give to you. It's a little bit different to do that with fully grown adults. But that hasn't stopped government agents from attempting and actually succeeding, Chuck, in doing this. Now, as I mentioned, the National Center for Public Policy Research is doing this lunch-in on the mall in Washington, D.C. at Freedom Plaza, aptly named Freedom Plaza, and everybody was having the same lunch the little girl was having, turkey and cheese sandwich with the banana and the apple and the potato chips, and they were trying to make a point. And their point was is that the government shouldn't be coming in and mandating and dictating our food choices. Now, ladies and gentlemen, again, it's one thing with a four-year-old child. It should be another thing with fully grown adults. However, that's part of the reason why we're having this program today, because, Chuck, as you know and I know, we've been looking at this. Back just about a week and a half ago, these federal government agents won a big, big prize. See, it's all about Dan Allgaier. Dan Allgaier, he's nobody, okay? He's like us. He's nobody. But the point is that Dan Allgaier was a farmer, Pennsylvania Amish, by the way, who had a company, a farm called Rainbow Acres Farm. What did Rainbow Acres Farm do? They had cows. I know so far people are sitting there scratching their head listening to this program saying, okay, I don't see what the issue is here. Well, let's keep going. Those cows gave milk. That milk was then sold to people all over the country and even in the Washington, D.C. area. The kicker is the milk is just as it came out of the cow, raw. See, Dan Allgaier and Rainbow Acre Farms was a major supplier of raw milk. And they were selling it to their clients, not just in Pennsylvania, but in Maryland and in the D.C. area and probably some in Ohio and in other states. In other words, he was shipping all over the place. Well, the feds didn't really like that idea. That in the U.S. Food and Drug Administration basically has mounted a war over the last 2 years to try to get control of Dan Allgaier and his renegade radical raw milk. So what happened is that 2 years ago, the FDA did what the FDA is known to do, and we've seen this happen in Ohio, here in northern Ohio, with another family that was dealing with, you know, going outside of the governmentally approved standards. They conducted a raid on his farm. Came in with the whole thing, with the folks in the black outfits and the firearms drawn and everything else, and scaring everybody to death. And basically, they were trying to get evidence. They'd actually planted something. They did a fake buy in order to try to trap this guy. Then came running in, illegally trespassing on his property. They come in there, they seize all of his records and everything else, basically to try to find evidence. The fact that he's violating the law by selling someone something they want.
Yeah.
Raw milk. So this was in February of 2010. Well, what happened here just last week, a little over two years to the day, is that the FDA and the federal government finally got Dan Allgaier to cry uncle. It's because what he did was, after the raid, he said, you know what? Okay, I got a little problem here, because the feds came in and basically said, well, you are producing milk for food for human consumption, and you're shipping it across state lines. It's interstate commerce. So therefore, we can regulate you, and we say you can't do it. So Dan thought, okay, all right, what do we do that? Okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to have my clients purchase shares in the cows. That way, they own it already, and all I'm doing is giving them the proceeds of what they own. In other words, he's giving them the dividend.
Yes. Yeah.
It's a dividend. He's giving them the dividend. Well, the FDA didn't like this at all, because this was actually getting around what they felt to be their scheme of regulation.
Well, I guess he's lucky he didn't get in trouble with the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Well, that way, and that's the question of whether how much we're going to monetize raw milk.
But yeah, exactly.
And actually, we might want to do that someday real soon, because it may be more valuable than our paper we have.
Well, listen, it has an intrinsic value, something that paper money does not have, but that's another show.
Yeah. So basically, he did these basically private share agreements. So a customer could buy a share of a cow, and that would give them so much. Let's say each cow produced, 60 gallons a year of milk, which is low, but I'm just, you know, ballparking.
Yeah.
So don't be emailing or calling us farmers saying, hey, yes, a good cow can produce. I, you know, it could be hundreds of gallons, but the point is, we're going to say 60 gallons. Yeah. Let's say 20 people buy a cow that produces 60 gallons of milk. That means each of them gets 3 gallons per year. Okay. Great. That's fine. And, you know, and they're paying a minimal amount to buy this share. And he just ships them their 3 gallons of milk. And he made, I'm sure that they could have determined whether they wanted it a gallon at a time or a quart at a time or a pint at a time. You know, he probably shipped it whatever way they wanted to.
Yeah,
and they
sure.
just paid a shipping fee. But the FDA, what happens is then that means the individual owns the cow. And so, therefore, when they consume the milk, they're only consuming what they already own. And so, therefore, the FDA doesn't have any regulatory jurisdiction over it.
Well, you think.
Well, that's what Dan Allgaier thought.
Yeah.
What happened was is that a federal judge in Pennsylvania on February the 3rd of this year decided that, you know what? I don't care with these sharing agreements. You're still in violation of interstate commerce because you can't consume all the milk that you're producing on your farm. So therefore, that means you must be putting it out for others to consume, and that's a violation of interstate. It's Wickard versus Filburn all over
exactly.
again.
Exactly. It's Wickard versus Filburn.
Okay, so basically, the judge decided that the FDA has rights, regulatory rights over private property use, because honestly, it may have affected Dan Allgaier immediately, but it was all his customers who had bought shares in the cows. Now, Chuck, you tell me, honestly, if there's a call and you've got to take what you own, and there's like 20 of us and we all own one cow, what are we getting if we have to divvy it up?
Yeah, 5% of a cow.
We're getting hamburger. That's
yeah,
what we're
that's
getting.
Right.
We're not getting raw milk anymore. We're going to get hamburger.
Yeah, a 1,000-pound cow, you're going to get about
50 pounds
of meat. Yeah.
You're going to get 50 pounds of hamburger for your share.
And you're not going to get that much because there's bone and gristle and all kinds of stuff involved. Well,
yeah,
so.
That's true. But the whole point is that by this ruling by this judge and the FDA's, shall we say, overzealous enforcement of a regulation that doesn't apply, Dan Allgaier has shut down Rainbow Acres Farm. Now, you know, we've got friends. You and I both have friends who are definitely proponents of raw milk, who are proponents of a freedom principle.
I'm a proponent of raw milk when I was a kid. In fact, yes. Let me give people, just as a sidebar, something they need to look for. They need to look at something called the Price-Pottinger Cat Studies.
Okay.
Because what the Price-Pottinger Cat Studies actually did was, it looked at the effects of feeding cats their entire lives, pasteurized milk versus raw milk.
Ooh.
And what they discovered was that cats that were fed raw milk thrived. Fat, happy, thick fur, healthy cats that were also great hunters.
Mm-hmm.
And after about the third generation of pasteurized milk, the cats were sickly. They had bone degeneration. They were lethargic. They stopped producing 100% live young.
Aha. Uh-huh.
They started producing a number of dead, and some of them had entire litters dead. And you can find if you look on Amazon, you can find a copy of the Price-Pottinger Cat Studies film where they actually show the film of the effects of raw milk. And so when I was a kid, my parents used to buy raw milk at a local farm. The guy wasn't an Amish guy, but he would sell it to us because we told him we were feeding it to our animals, which was true. And our animals had a great increase in their health. We fed it to cats and also to our dog, who thrived on that. And we fed it to ourselves while we were at it. And let me tell you, I've never had more delicious milk than when I had cold, raw milk merely hours out of the cow.
Well, little admission here, a little background on me. I grew up on an 80-cow dairy farm. We milked Holstein cattle. And it was nothing for me to go running into the holding tank. This is raw milk now.
Sure.
We had one of those big stainless steel, keeping it chilled at about 40 degrees holding tanks that all that milk would go pumping. You know, we had basically, it was an 8-stall milk parlor, and that milk would get pumped into the tank. And there was a long handled dipper that was about this deep
yeah.
and about that bigger.
Well,
you know,
they can't see that.
Yeah, it's about half an inch around.
It's 6 inches deep and about, in diameter, it's probably about 3 inches.
Yeah, that's right. I told you I had a face for radio and a voice for press. I can't even do
and
this.
And the handle's probably about 12,
12 to 14 inches or so. But it was nothing to take that dipper and to dip into that tank and pour out a nice little cup of raw milk. Nothing finer. Nothing finer. I mean, that's part of what I grew up on. So, honestly, this is something that they've tried to make a boogeyman out of it. Of course, right after the feds got through doing this, all of a sudden they roll out a study saying that, you know, in 200 of 230 some cases, we found that, you know, the health issues related to the consumption of raw milk. And I say, stop just a minute.
Right.
The whole point is, if you have a farm that understands what they're doing, they understand that before you milk the cows, you have to do what we had to do on the farm, and that is to basically, like when you go to wash your hands and you use antibacterial hand soap, well, you would use that same thing on the udders of the teats of the cows before you would milk them.
And also,
so that you wouldn't get those kind of bacteria and things into the milk.
If you maintain the health of your cows and regularly test your product,
There should be no problem.
The one major issue that everybody screams about is brucellosis. And there has not been a brucellosis outbreak from raw milk in within any of our lifetimes.
No. You're right. There absolutely hasn't been. But the whole point here, Chuck, is that what's happened is you have a federal agency, the Food and Drug Administration. First of all, questionable constitutionality for even having this agency.
Beyond questionable.
Well, I was going to say, you might be able to stretch really far in the enumerated powers.
Well, all I can say is thank Theodore Roosevelt, good old Teddy, progressive Teddy, because this was his brainchild. And basically, it grew out of a failed lawsuit against Coca-Cola.
Wow. Okay. There wasn't enough cocaine in the cola?
Well, that's just it. The federal government sued them for having cocaine, and they said, we haven't had cocaine in this product in 20 years. We took it out a long, long, long time ago. So this was the great Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1908. It essentially was a complete fraud, and of course it was all rebuilt after the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1934, right smack in the middle of the most progressive presidency of the 20th century. And that wasn't Teddy Roosevelt, but his cousin, Franklin.
Franklin D. That's right. It all gets down to Franklin. And it's funny you're mentioning Franklin Roosevelt, because that's leading me to where I'm going to next. And that is that what we have now is the harvest from the seeds that were planted in that time frame, not just with Teddy and creating all of these progressive social agencies, because there was this conceptualization that government had to step in to protect the public. Government had to step in to keep us from harming ourselves. So we had to create the Food and Drug Administration. We had to create the antitrust laws, things of that nature. All these different types of progressive social policies all came home and roosted during that time period. And then when Franklin Roosevelt came in, then you saw when he did this court packing, this shift in the courts about how we interpreted how the Constitution, and specifically the Commerce Clause, how it impacted the states. Because before that, the Commerce Clause, and folks, because you know we're constitutionalists, we're talking about Article 1, Section 8, and I think it's Clause, 3?
Something.
I don't have my constitution in front of me right now, and I hate to admit that, but I don't have mine right here in the studio.
I have three copies, and I'll grab one right now.
You do that. I think it's Article 1, Section 8, and then maybe it's Clause 3 about the regulation of commerce. Yes, it is an enumerated power of our Congress. And notice how I'm being very careful about spelling this out. It is an enumerated power of our Congress to regulate commerce, first of all, with foreign nations, secondly, among the several states, and thirdly, with the Indian tribes.
Yeah.
Okay? So that is when our founders wrote this, that's what they were looking at is, okay, we have to have a system where when we're going to be doing something as the United States with a foreign nation, we've got to be able to have the flexibility to be able to say how we're going to handle it. In other words, it's dealing with regulating commerce about tariffs and imposts and duties and excises.
Okay, let's talk about what the wiggle word here. Can you know what it is?
Yeah, oh yes, I do know
it's
what
the word
is.
Regulate.
It's the word regulate,
now,
that's right.
What the founders meant by that becomes very clear when you read their writings.
Yes.
What they meant was, during the Articles of Confederation period, there was no federal, quote-unquote, regulation of interstate commerce. So what was happening? You had to pay a duty. For instance, if you had a port in Philadelphia and you wanted to bring stuff into New Jersey or maybe Delaware,
right,
you had to pay a duty to cross the border from that port in Pennsylvania, let's say Philadelphia, into Delaware or into New Jersey. And what was happening was that large states that had a port were lording it over small states who had little access to or had no really, you know, decent waterfront facilities and, you know, really had no bays or inlets or places that lent themselves to that. So what you had was you had a gross imbalance between the states based on the fact that they were taxing one another for shipping and receiving goods. And the United States was founded as a commercial trading republic. In other words, you had to make goods and trade with other countries and other states in order to make your economy run. So what was happening was that places like New York and Pennsylvania were making money hand over fist by charging those smaller states who didn't have that access these giant fees so they could ship and receive goods. That is what is meant by interstate commerce. And the fact is that every state, including New York and Philadelphia or in Pennsylvania,
yes,
and those states with ports understood that this situation could not stand, that something had to be done to fix it. Therefore, they put in that clause about regulation of interstate commerce, which basically says, if you look further on in the Constitution, you basically, it's in our, Section 9, I believe, Section 9 or 10, that you cannot charge a duty without the approval of Congress between states. So that's exactly what was meant by interstate commerce regulation. It had nothing to do with whether you were going to ship raw milk over a state border. In fact, what was being done by the regulation of interstate commerce was the encouragement of the shipment of goods over a state border, not the discouragement,
right,
of the shipment of goods over a state border.
You're absolutely right. And that section you reference is Article 1, Section 9, Clause 5 of the Constitution.
See, I knew I was in the right.
Which states, no tax, yeah, or duty shall be laid on articles exported from any state. No preference shall be given to any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over those of another. Nor shall vessels bound to or from one state be obliged to enter, clear, or pay duties in another. So, yes, they were dealing with this directly. They prohibited certain things and gave Congress enumerated power to regulate in the other clause.
Yeah, and the reason for that is, too, one of the problems that the federal government had under the Articles of Confederation is that it had no way of raising revenue except by the states paying dues, which very often the states just sort of thumbed their nose at the whole thing and said, we're not paying our dues. Well, the reason that the states can't impose an export duty is because that was left to the federal government as a revenue source.
That's exactly right.
And unfortunately, you had guys that were committed nationalists like Alexander Hamilton who wanted to expand that power to into a protectionist tariff. In other words, to protect industries like textiles and ironworking and steel making, sort of fledgling industries in the United States at that time, and he wanted to protect them through the use of the protective tariff. It's a long-standing debate, but the fact is that protective tariffs essentially don't work. What you end up doing is keeping artificially high prices and excluding your goods from the place who doesn't like paying those protective, and so on whatever goods you're exporting, they run the tariff up in retaliation. It ends up creating tariff wars, which essentially keep prices high.
Mm-hmm.
And the only people that benefit are governments.
Well, you know, and it's interesting you say this because it goes to more than that. I think this is where I want to try to tie our two themes in together today.
Yes.
And that is, we have a situation where we have a federal agency, the FDA, which honestly is unconstitutional, who is actually part of the executive branch of government, who are going out there and saying, we're going to regulate you because you're engaging in interstate commerce by producing a food product that people want and that they're paying for. And you can't do that because we're not approving it. Now, we have the same situation here on that micro scale at that little preschooler in North Carolina, where a government agent is saying, your food product that you want isn't allowable, and you are going to take what we tell you you can have.
Yes.
See, it's a small step from prohibiting people having the freedom to engage in commerce to forcing them to engage in certain granted, allowable, governmentally approved forms of commerce. And of course, ladies and gentlemen, you know where I'm going to with this, and that's Obamacare. The mandate on health care is one of the natural outworkings of this absolute, what we call, super elastic mentality that the federal government has over the Commerce Clause. And this happened, during the FDR administration, because prior to that, many of the cases specifically limited only if what the state action was doing was impinging upon an enumerated power of the Congress, such as what we've just talked about,
right,
as far as Article 1, Section 9, Clause 5. It was during the FDR administration where the courts had what we call a sea change in their thinking and decided that the Commerce Clause could impact just about anything in life. And we've talked about on this program before the case of Wickard versus Filburn, and you say it so much more eloquently than I do. Remind folks what Wickard versus Filburn was all about.
Wickard versus Filburn basically had to do with a farmer who grew, I think, 55 acres extra wheat. It was some double-digit number like that. And essentially, he grew it, and he basically used it to feed his livestock. But what the federal government did was they sued him because there was, at the time, a quota. And they said, you can't grow that amount. It doesn't matter. And the way the court decision worked was, it said, if you had not grown that extra wheat, you would have had to go to the grain elevator to buy it. And the chances are some of it would have come from out of state.
Yes,
therefore, it affected interstate commerce. Now, if you hadn't fed it to your cattle, you may have taken it to the grain elevator where it would have been sold, and some of it very easily could have gone into interstate commerce by being sold to someone out of state. Therefore, no matter what you did with that extra 55 acres, interstate commerce would have been affected.
So, in other words, it was a darned if you do, darned if you don't kind of situation.
There was no way to win.
Well, and you see, folks, and there had been a buildup of this because originally the interpretation of the Commerce Clause was if an estate actor is engaging in something that is restricted or reserved to the purview of the federal government through Congress, then it could be acted upon. However, things like mining and manufacturing and other things, they said, no, we're purely state actions. We talked about this before, too, about our efforts.
Montana.
But a number of our efforts in Montana and other states to say we're going to get around federal gun laws by just producing it in state. Well, that would have been okay before about 1937. But from up to 1937, there were restrictions, but they were slowly being chipped away. And you had, like, the Sherman Antitrust Acts, the trust busting. And if you ever study history, you're reading history from a progressive viewpoint, because it was around those times, from the 1880s to about the late 1920s, that all of these changes were occurring. And then if you look at the historians, they're all writing that this was a wonderful and glowing thing.
Yes.
Because what it is it's socialism. to come in and say government can tell individual actors that they can and can't play together, or they can and can't engage in commerce with each other, is a form of, well, actually, it's a form of fascism.
It's a bottom line. What the founding fathers called a tyranny.
It's a tyranny,
and they knew it up front. They knew it face to face because they had just fought a revolution to rid themselves of it. Essentially, they had a king who would send a minister, some kind of a viceroy type person, mm-hmm. to come over here and regulate certain things. For instance, colonists were not allowed to do things like build ships. They had to be, the lumber had to be shipped to England for the ships to be built and shipped back here. There were other things that were not allowed. There was no manufacturing, for the most part, that was allowed in any colony.
No.
The colonies were to ship raw materials to England where things would be manufactured, and they would be manufactured under what's known as a royal charter.
Mm-hmm.
And the royal charter, the person who had the royal charter would pay the crown a royalty. And in return for that royalty, they would have their market protected by not allowing the colonies to do the manufacturing themselves. So what you had was essentially what was called mercantilism, and which really was a precursor, and not a very thinly veiled precursor, almost fully developed into what became known later as corporatism and then fascism. And all corporatism was essentially turning these operations into multiple owned corporations, things like the East India Tea Company.
Yes.
That was an early corporation. It was an early chartered corporation. And so that melded into Italian fascism. So when we say something is fascist, essentially its roots go back to British mercantilism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to note that there were people at the Constitutional Convention who were interested in creating that system in the United States.
Yes, there were.
Alexander Hamilton being a noted example, he really wanted to set up a mercantilist system.
Well, he got his wish, he just didn't live to see it.
That's the bottom line. But there were early protective tariffs as part of the package,
mm-hmm.
government chartered things wherein there is protection given to the market and that kind of thing.
Well, and that's what we're seeing with the expansion of the commerce
clause. Exactly.
Because like I said, when you got to in the 1880s, 1890s, the Sherman Antitrust Act, what happened was that historic move of, as long as it's not specifically spelled out and enumerated that it's Congress's role that the states are infringing on, became, okay, does it have a direct effect on interstate commerce or an indirect effect?
Yes.
And originally, all the way, even going up into the 19-teens and 1920s, the court said, if it has a direct effect, Congress can regulate it. But if it has an indirect effect, i.e. Wickard versus Filburn, which came later, Congress had no authority to regulate it to the states because it was still left to the states' purview via the 10th Amendment. So we keep rolling and we get to 1937.
Yep.
We get to the apex of the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration, where through his activist socialist push, the courts cried uncle.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Ultimately, the courts cried uncle because the federal government wanted the power to control all aspects of commerce across the 50 states. Well, at that time, there weren't 50. I understand, so nobody called me on that. Yeah. 48. Yeah. Alaska and Hawaii hadn't gotten here yet. So, but anyhow, so here FDR decided they wanted to try to, and it was over something that we just dealt with last November, and that is wage and labor laws.
Mm-hmm.
So the New Deal, FDR's New Deal program, they wanted to push and push and push. And in 1935, a case called L.A. Schechter Poultry versus the United States, the court struck down regulations that fixed the wages and hours. So why do we have a minimum wage now? Why do we have federally mandated saying, okay, if you work so many hours, you're part-time, you work so many hours, you're three-quarter time, and you get and you work so many hours, that's full-time, and then everything after that's overtime. Why do we have that? Because Roosevelt went to work. When he didn't get his way in the courts, he decided, we're going to expand the courts. We're going to add seats to the court.
It's even better than that. Here's the way he did it. Any justice over the age of 70 is obviously needs an assistant. So what we will do is we will appoint an extra Supreme Court seat for every judge over the age of 70. And what this justice will be an associate justice that will be there to help
the senior justices
make the decisions that they need to make. Now, anybody who doesn't think that any kind of government regulatory action on the courts doesn't work, this scared the Supreme Court justices to death.
And that was 2 years later, in 1937, they showed just exactly how frightened they were.
The court packing scheme, and this is why we say all it would take would be the impeachment. And it doesn't even have to be the successful impeachment. It would have to be the impeachment of one Supreme Court justice. It doesn't even have to be successful.
That's right.
Meaning a conviction and removal from office. The Supreme Court will come to heel real fast.
Very fast. But what the Supreme Court did, it was a case, the National Labor Relations Board, one of our old buddies who've been trying to tell companies where they can and can't locate now in the country. Remember?
Yes. Boeing.
Yeah, the Boeing issue. And we've talked about that on this program. But the NLRB in 1937 was battling Jones Laughlin Steel Corporation over wage and hour issues. Now, of course, in 1935, in another case, it basically said the NLRB doesn't have any power over that because that's purely a state-level issue. 1937, after FDR's court-packing scheme, all of a sudden the courts came up with this logic where they basically broke down any remaining barrier to the federal control over commerce, no matter how big or small, no matter where it lurked, whether it was inside the purview of the enumerated powers clause of the federal government, or if it was something that the states had historically had their own caveat over. And they said, quote, that intrastate, that's inside a single
state. Yep.
Intrastate activities that, quote, have such a close and substantial relation to interstate commerce that their control is essential or appropriate to protect that commerce from burdens and obstructions are within the power of Congress to regulate. You talk about handing the keys and a bottle of whiskey to a 16-year-old kid and saying, have fun. This is what the courts did for the for the executive branch, FDR and subsequent administrations. They basically said, you now have carte blanche.
Yeah. I think that's the P.J. O'Rourke quote just came up with. Yeah, giving absolute power to the courts is like giving whiskey and car keys to 16-year-olds.
Yeah. Right. Oh, my goodness. And so then from 1937 to now, we have experienced the bitter fruits of the seeds that got sown there as the courts decided they did not want to have the clash between the power. They didn't want to put the check on the federal government because I believe, Chuck, they saw that that was a way for them to ultimately gain more control over the federal government.
Sure.
And we've seen this. I mean, and it works itself out in so many ways, including McCain-Feingold, Campaign Finance Act. It works itself out in the various issues, the Kelo decision, where the government is just going to basically use that interstate commerce clause as a rubber stamp for expanding federal authority no matter what.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why you and I have been sort of very disdainful of everyone telling us that the bottom line on Obamacare and abortion and so many other things lies in the hands of the Supreme Court. Folks, if you're relying on the Supreme Court to come up with an original intent interpretation of the Constitution regarding Obamacare, regarding abortion, regarding virtually anything, any kind of regulatory activity, you are simply barking up the wrong tree. In fact, you may want to have yourself checked for mental illness because it's not going to happen. And the only way it's going to happen is if Congress steps in and regulates the courts the way they're supposed to.
Well, you see, Chuck, and I bring that point up, and I'm glad you're saying
that. Well, actually, there's another way.
There is. Well, go before you say that, I want to go into this. Because a lot of what we're talking about has come from our good friend Joel McDermott down at American Vision, who wrote an article And honestly, Chuck, he wrote this article 2 years ago called The Highway to Hell, The Progressive Tyranny Over Interstate Commerce. And so what he thinks that the courts have shown us that they're willing to step off of this and rein in the federal government through the Congress. So it's a kind of a backwards thing where the court wants to rein in the Congress from basically stepping all over everybody, Obamacare, in pursuit of commerce. Because he's looking at a case from 1995, the Lopez decision that he's looking at, and I'm trying to see what the, if I can find, or U.S. versus Lopez. I was thinking it was Lopez versus U.S., but it's U.S. versus Lopez in 1995, and he outlined something that the court said here. Lopez was a situation about the zero tolerance policies, public schools, and bringing weapons to schools.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They always pick a nice neutral issue to create massive waves of
poor
precedent.
Well, look, if you want to crank up emotions, talk about guns in school.
Guns in schools, that's right. Beyond that topic, what he's and McDermott quotes in his article here, and this is where he's hanging a lot of his hope. And he says that in the court's ruling on this, in this decision, the court says that, and he says, and I quote, "Under the theories that the government presents, it is difficult to perceive any limitation on federal power, even in areas such as criminal law enforcement or education, where states historically have been sovereign."
Okay. Oh, the S word.
Now, I'm okay with that. Now, but the point is, let's keep going. He's in the court. This is still the court's rationale. "Thus, if we were to accept the government's arguments, which means that they can regulate anything, anytime, anywhere, including education because of the Gun-Free Schools Act, we are hard-pressed to posit any activity by an individual that Congress is without power to regulate." Okay. That was only part of their rationale. He gets to the kicker about the decision, the conclusion of the decision. He says, "To uphold the government's contentions here, we would have to pile inference upon inference in a manner that would bid fair to convert congressional authority under the Commerce Clause to a general police power of the sort retained by the states." Now, I beg the question here. I'm going off script. I'm begging the question. Where does do the states still retain any police power? I've not seen it lately.
Oh, wow.
I don't think there is much of an area where they retain sovereign control and police power anymore in this country.
Well, that's been stripped.
Totally.
Yeah. Essentially, there are, let's put it this way. There are states that have quote unquote state defense forces.
Uh-huh.
Ohio actually has one because I've met a guy who's involved in it. he said, "I'm in the real militia." And I go, "Oh, you mean Ohio has one of those?" And he said, "Yeah, they do. There's not that many of us, but we do train, and we are actually not in the National Guard, and we are actually called the Ohio Defense Force."
That's amazing.
And I'm shocked. I was shocked because that is Ohio. The militia... Yes. Originally was Ohio's
defense force.
Police.
That's right.
Defense force power. And its police power.
That's right. Now, and it keeps going. This is the court's decision. Admittedly, some of our prior cases have taken long steps down that road to basically handing the federal government everything. "Giving great deference to congressional action, the broad language in these opinions has suggested the possibility of additional expansion, but we decline here to proceed any further. To do so would require us to conclude that the Constitution's enumeration of powers does not presuppose something not enumerated, and that there never will be a distinction between what is truly national and what is truly local. This we are unwilling to do." Okay, now this is the U.S. Supreme Court from 1995. My problem with this is, Charles, as you know, I've had a lot of experience in reading legislative intent and reading the text of law and how the artfulness of language, let's put it that way. I believe the court has not signaled what our good friend Mr. McDermott actually thinks that they're signaling, which is we're ready to get off this road and to put chains back on the Commerce Clause. Because they say we decline here
yes.
to proceed any further, just in this one case. And that the whole idea that that we would have to conclude that the Constitution enumeration of power does not presuppose something not enumerated. That's not what they were asked. And it says that there never will be a distinction between what is truly national and what is truly local. Did you get that? There never will be a distinction. What they're admitting is there is no real distinction right now.
Yes.
Because of where the courts have gone already, there is no true distinction between national and local because of the abuse of the Commerce
Clause. The language is all future tense.
When
you go backwards, there definitely is a distinction between what is national and what is local.
And there was, but the point is that because, and even this court, and this was 1995, so this was before John Roberts and Samuel Alito and
Sandra Sotomayor
and Elena Kagan. But the point is that even then, those justices dealt with what they call stare decisis. So they didn't break any huge constitutional ground here. They just said in this one case, we're not going to allow turn education into a business to be regulated as commerce. And yes, we've gone farther. You know, the broad language in these opinions, and they're looking at the history of the Commerce Clause jurisprudence, have suggested the possibility of additional expansion. Charles, okay, I'm going to ask the stupid question here. How do you expand past 100%?
Well, yeah.
How do you? Because right now we're talking about the FDA shutting down an Amish farmer because he's selling raw milk, and he wasn't even then. He wasn't even selling. He was selling shares in cows, and they were just taking what was theirs. But the FDA said we can regulate it because of the Commerce Clause. Now we have in North Carolina, we're going to take lunches away from little girls and hand them government-approved pre-processed food because we've decided what's nutritious and what's not. Now, they didn't use the Commerce Clause in that case, but you can see the parallels to what we're dealing with health care, what we're dealing with so many other issues out there, is that only if the circumstances are just exactly perfect will the court even remotely consider backing down away from the doctrine of stare decisis.
And Barry, here's the problem that people just can't seem to get. And that is, we're not going to get a decent Supreme Court until we get a decent Congress.
Well, okay, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to, if you've heard nothing else we said all day long, but you're still listening, turn your volume up a little bit and get rid of your distractions and listen to this next thing. Chuck said it right. We're not going to get a Supreme Court that's right until we get a good Congress, not a good president. The president only nominates potential justices. It is up to the Senate. So really, we need a good Senate mainly. But the point is, we need a Congress, which means we need a good House as well, who are willing to go toe-to-toe with a court that's renegade and restrain them by restricting their jurisdiction. They can do that in Article 3. You can restrict the jurisdiction of all federal courts, including the United States Supreme Court.
That's right.
They can remove judges by impeachment. They can also remove entire circuits of the federal courts from time to time, as it says that they can make courts, which means that they also, as implied, have the power to eliminate those courts.
It's beyond implied. It's a concomitant power.
It's a concomitant power. You're right.
We've talked about that before. There is no such thing as an implied power.
That's correct.
There is a concomitant power, and that is the power to create is also the power to destroy. And in fact, if they want to break down, for instance, the Ninth Circuit, no problem. It's gone. The best way to do that would be to say we are dissolving the Ninth Circuit, and we will come out with now a split circuit. There has been talk about splitting that circuit forever. It'd be a great way to get a new handle on a really terrible, terrible district. The Ninth Circuit is just awful. And the way to do it is, we're dissolving that. And then you reconstitute it as two or three new circuits.
Yes.
Because that thing handles the entire West Coast. Alaska, Washington, Oregon, California,
Idaho. The Ninth Circuit is a very huge circuit.
Yeah.
But the whole key is, Charles, You're absolutely right. We have to be worried and focused and putting our effort and our energy. If we're going to deal at the federal level, we can't moan and groan about what the court does and doesn't do. We can't moan and groan about who is or who isn't president, who will be appointing justice. You notice they always say he's appointing. The president never appoints a justice. He nominates them.
That's right.
It is the United States Senate. First, the Senate Judiciary Committee screens the candidates and votes whether or not to recommend that nominee to the full Senate for their consideration. It's not a foregone conclusion, ladies and gentlemen. If they pass the Senate Judiciary Committee, and you get a senator who gets up on the floor of the full Senate and wants to filibuster because they found out something about this candidate for the bench that they don't like, guess what? That person isn't guaranteed a seat on the court because the president put their name in and because the committee said, okay, we think they're good.
Harriet Myers.
Harriet Myers under George W. Bush is a perfect example.
Yes.
These are people.
I don't even think she got, did she even get a full hearing?
She didn't get a full hearing. She had to withdraw.
Yeah.
But the whole point is, ladies and gentlemen, it's not about the president. Everybody talks about this is the most important election in our lifetime. Yes, it is, but you're focusing on the wrong
election.
That's it. It's not the election to the president that really makes the difference. It's who you're putting in Congress. And whether or not you're sitting in the 10th district, the 12th district, the 7th district, the 5th district, I don't care. We got 16 congressional districts in the state of Ohio. We have 435 congressional districts nationwide. If we can only focus our attention on putting people who understand, appreciate, and will adhere to the restrictions in the Constitution of the United States, we'll solve judicial tyranny. We'll also solve the imperial presidency. But the point is, if we're all distracted by which rock star is going to be our next nominee for president, we are much to be pitied.
And if we allow them to get distracted by asking questions like, who here is for contraception and who isn't? And if you heard any excerpts from the presidential debate done on Wednesday night, what an embarrassment. The news media attempted what it likes to do, and that is ask a gotcha question.
Yes.
And discovered that the Republican faithful aren't really putting up with a whole lot of that. The question got asked and the moderator got booed, not just a little. I mean, essentially almost drowned out by the booing. He says, I see this is a really popular question. Yeah, well, withdraw it because it's an absurdity. It's sort of like, now I don't care much for Mitt Romney, but the answer that he gave on the question when George Stephanopoulos asked him about do you believe it's a state's right to outlaw a contraceptive? And Mitt Romney said, it's a stupid question.
Yes.
And Stephanopoulos said, you need to answer the question. And he said, name me a state that's attempting to outlaw a contraceptive. Or one even is talking about it. It's a moot question. And he says, you need to answer whether they have the right to or not. And Romney answered it wrong and said they probably don't, which in fact they probably do because...
Well, it's not just a probable. If you look at the United States Constitution, there's no place where Congress in Article 1, Section 8 or Section 9 either has the enumerated power or the states are denied the enumerated power to deal with issues relating to contraception.
Well, good luck pulling that off. Now, Connecticut had a law, and that's one of the basis of Roe v. Wade, was a law in Connecticut that did outlaw the use of certain kinds of contraceptives. And the name of the case now escapes me. It doesn't really matter. We could look that up. But the fact is that it is one of the precursors. It's considered the precursor of Roe v. Wade. So the answer is, yeah, they can do that. And but who would want to? And this is the kind of nonsense when they should be talking about things like getting rid of Obamacare, bringing home the troops. How is national defense to be conducted? How is foreign policy to be conducted? They're getting questions on contraception. Sorry, ladies and gentlemen. No, That's not a legitimate question. And in fact, it's designed to evoke an emotional response, and it's designed to call attention away from the central issues of the campaign in order to give the current occupant of the White House a leg up.
That's right. And by the way, that case you were looking for is Griswold versus Connecticut, 1965.
Yes, Griswold v. Connecticut.
Which was the precursor case to Roe. It laid the groundwork so that the courts could come in and approve Roe in 1973.
And as always, we could go on and on and on and on, but we can't because we're out of time. So join us again on Monday for another Principles and Policies.
And see yourself in a good Bible-believing, Bible-preaching church tomorrow, and we hope that maybe we'll see you in one.